Thank you all so much. Good morning. I'm Rachel Long, and I'm the current president of Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. Prairie aspires to be both an open-minded and an open-hearted congregation. We welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, or family structure. We welcome you no matter your age, your abilities, or your inabilities. Toward the end of the service, guests and visitors will have an opportunity to introduce themselves. If you've been to Prairie only once or twice, or you've been away for a while, we hope you'll feel comfortable enough to introduce yourselves to us at that time and give us a little idea what brought you here. On Sunday mornings, we have a wide variety of services presented either by one of our own members or from someone in the wider community or by our minister, Ralph Tiksinski. And today we have the pleasure of presenting Dr. Thomas Givnish, who will be speaking on evolution on islands. And it's time already for our first hymn, which will be For the Beauty of the Earth, number 21 in your hymnal. And our accompanist, Eileen Nettleton. Ooh. And please stand. As we light the chalice today, please consider the following words, which will be presented by Bob Park.
It is interesting to contemplate a tangled bank clothed with many plants of many kinds, with birds singing on the bushes, with various insects flitting about, and with worms crawling through the damp earth, and to reflect that these elaborately constructed forms, so different from each other and dependent upon each other in so complex a manner, have been produced by laws acting around us. These laws, taken in the largest sense, being growth with reproduction, inheritance, which is almost implied by reproduction, variability from the indirect and direct action of the conditions of life, and from use and disuse, a ratio of increase so high as to lead to a struggle for life and as a consequence to natural selection, entailing divergence of character and the extinction of less improved forms. Thus, from the war of nature, from famine and death, the most exalted object which we are capable of conceiving, namely the production of higher animals, directly follows. There is grandeur in this view of life, and with its several powers, having been originally breathed by the Creator in a few forms or into one, and that, whilst the planet has gone circling on according to the fixed law of gravity, from so simple a beginning, endless forms, most beautiful and most wonderful, have been and are being evolved. Charles Darwin.
Let us now enter a time of silence. As a caring community, we now have a time to briefly share any special joys, concerns, sorrows with our prairie friends. And Dorothy has a microphone.
Well, the joy is that basically straight from here, Bob and I are heading off to Florida for a couple of weeks. And I'm hoping that that bakes my voice back. Because the doctor gave me a number of restrictions, including do not sing under any circumstances, and you can imagine that is the hardest one.
It's a joy that Galen is with us today after falling on the ice, and also to thank you to all the wonderful people who've offered help, and to Ken, who brought us this morning, and we'll need a ride back from the Humanist Union. But thanks to everybody for being so kind and thoughtful.
I guess you'd call this a concern. I just started reading the book, 90 Minutes in Heaven, and I wondered, who are all these people involved? And it turns out they're all evangelical Christians. And of course, they're promoting the idea of an afterlife. And that's our problem with the Muslims, with the radical, with the extremists, who, you know, talk about joy after death. And this really bothers me that the Christians are now doing the same thing, promoting this idea of an afterlife.
Just one joy and one concern. I had a statewide conference for my profession this week down in Lake Geneva. And for those that don't know me, I do geographic information systems. We make maps from databases and all sorts of fun things. And much to my great surprise, not only did my map that I brought for the map competition win runner-up, I was also awarded the Local Government Achievement Award for the program that I run at the City of Sun Prairie. And in addition to the gain in job security this provided, I got a wonderful glass earth orb, solid about the size of a softball, that has the continents and islands etched into it. And it's on an acrylic stand, which is engraved with my name and the award and the year. And if I spin the globe on the acrylic stand, it spins, and it's really wonderful. So, yeah, it's in my car if anybody must see it. I'm showing it to my father-in-law after so that I can take it to work on Monday. And I'm really looking forward to the Monday morning staff meeting. So. The minor concern I have is that our schedule is so full that we have four tickets to the women's basketball game at noon today that we can't use. So if anyone can help us use them, please see me after. It's noon today, women's basketball, UW versus somebody.
Well, last week was so full of joys and concerns that I didn't mention that we had a very nice trip to New York and Boston the 2 weeks previous to that, and went to the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which we will be talking about next week, but also had a chance to greet a new member of the family, my niece's first granddaughter. And then we got home and found out another niece had a baby. Another great... Okay. Anyway, another baby came along, and this is my brother's first natural grandchild. And my brother is also struggling with his wife's deterioration with Alzheimer's disease, and he told me last week that they had entered her into a hospice program, which means she's kind of in the late stages. But he put that together with the new grandchild, and he's a good Unitarian out in California.
Well, I'm part of the group that had the shared joy this week, after the continuing joy from the auction, actually, of being out of commission for several days. But I look at it as just, you know, a sort of little extended absence that I got to do nothing for 2 days.
In case some of you don't know, it appears that this past weekend, spending so much time together, helped transmit some pretty nasty GI virus among us, which continues to make the rounds. But
wash hands.
Wash hands. Be friendly without breathing on your neighbor. That kind of thing. Anyone else?
Doesn't look like Rick's going to mention it, so I will. Some of us had the joy of going to Schwegler's Parktown Lanes on Friday night and seeing Marty Drapkin, who was a member of Prairie for quite a long time and who is now facing surgery on the 10th of March for bladder cancer, if you don't know Marty. But he was in great spirits and looked really good, and we had a lot of fun singing karaoke, so it was a good time.
I imagine everyone knows we made about $6,000 in the auction, and that was, I think, our closest was last year at $4,300, and before that we were always in the $3,000s, so people really gave.
My grandson is 17 and in high school, and he got a tattoo. And, well, since I have a tattoo, it's very difficult for me to criticize. But his was supposed to be up on his arm, but apparently the artist, quote, got carried away, and it's almost down to his elbow, apparently. And it's got grisly pictures and things on it. And we haven't seen it yet, but you don't criticize a person's tattoo because there's nothing you can do about it.
It's a joy to be up and around after surgery. And... I have to pass on a story about my family. I think that some of you have heard me say that I think I've met all of my cousins. Well, it turns out that I haven't. I have an aunt that is expected to live about another 2 weeks, and part of the dispute in her family has to do with, who are these people in your will anyway? And it turns out that she had two children before she was married, and both were put for adopts, and no one in the family, except apparently my grandmother, knew this. She had lived in another state at that time. So I have a larger extended family to learn about.
Since we mentioned tattoos, when our daughter had a tattoo and she showed it to us, it was gorgeous, and I said, oh, I'd much rather see it on paper.
Anyone else? Okay. Actually, Galen Smith, since he made it here after the various travails, will be introducing our speaker today. Emma, did I miss? Oh. Okay, Galen. I have to make you sit. I missed a song. You mean I was right?
Yes, you were right.
Miraculous. Okay, Galen. Since...
This one won't fall over. It's actually, I don't.
Don't think you need it.
Okay. By the grace of God, I'm here today. I fell. And Ken Skog, who drove me here.
God's helper, Ken Scott. Okay, as you already know, our speaker today is Professor Tom Givnish, sitting right here, who is Henry Allen Gleason Professor of Botany and Environmental Studies at the University of Wisconsin here in Madison. He earned his PhD in 1976 at Princeton University. His special interest areas are plant ecology and evolution. He and his students have pursued research in a wide variety of fascinating ecosystems and places. This is a very brief list, lots of them, such as the prairies and savannas of Midwestern United States, and these are fascinating places, of course. They happen to be close to home, but farther away from home, the cloud forests and bogs of Hawaii, the Florida Everglades, the rainforests of Central America, and the cloud forests and bogs on top of the tepuis in the ancient Guiana Shield of South America. Some of you know what the tepuis are. Maybe Tom can tell you a little more. Those are islands. His next adventure, I understand, will be a trip soon over spring break to the Galapagos Islands, so we can all envy him. Okay, and as you know, the title of his presentation today is Evolution of Life on Islands.
And if you want to use it in the clip, that's fine. Oh, no, please use the microphone.
Sure.
Yes.
I can project.
Yeah, we have a lot of people who
okay.
are,
right.
we tape it on the,
okay,
you know,
sounds
we
good.
Need it.
Well, Galen, thank you so much for those kind words, and I'm very happy to be here and to be talking about one of my favorite topics, evolution on islands. Islands have played an inspirational role from the very beginning in the theory of evolution, affecting certainly both Darwin through his visits to the Galapagos and also Alfred Russel Wallace, who spent several years at Monado on the island of Sulawesi, that is to say the Celebes, in the area near Southeast Asia. And today I'd like to offer a few reflections on what we've learned about evolution on islands since Darwin. Next. One of the important things to realize about islands is that they're geologically ephemeral. Most islands, being volcanic in the ocean, last no more than 3 or 4 or 6 or 7 million years. Sounds like a very long time, but relative to the age of the Earth, 5 billion years, it's a very short period of time. Relative to the history of life on Earth, a very, very short time. In addition, islands are extremely isolated from mainland source areas, and as a consequence of both of those factors, the extreme isolation and the short lifetime of islands, that means that representatives of very few lineages of plants, animals, and fungi and ever make it to them. Next. And so as a consequence, islands generally have many fewer species of plants and animals than mainland areas with the same latitude and the same climate. And there are many groups, for example, land mammals, that are missing. You know, they can't stroll over to Hawaii, right, or to Mauritius. Next. And, of course, another feature of it is that the few lineages that do arrive on the islands find a wide range of ecological resources that can be used and ultimately might be partitioned by different species. One has to recognize that because few groups ever make it to islands, there is often going to be much more competition among the members of those groups than they, or just among themselves, than they would experience in mainland source areas. And the result of that, next, is ultimately selection for what's called adaptive radiation. That is to say, for divergence among recently evolved species in their ecology and the way they make a living because of the strong competitive forces that they face. So today, as I said, I'd like to offer some reflections on what we've learned since Darwin about evolution on islands, talk about the origin and diversification of lineages, what we've learned about adaptive radiation, the rise of the tree-like habit of arborescence in island plants, of gigantism and dwarfism in many island animals, and the evolution of flightlessness in island birds and insects. Now, of course, the interest really goes back to Darwin's arrival in the Galapagos Islands in 1832. He had left England at the ripe age of 22 the year before, and it certainly is clear from his writings and the Origin of Species is his most famous book and his autobiography, that what he saw in the Galapagos Islands had a profound impact on him and really changed his mind in terms of the fixity of species and pointed him instead toward the theory of evolution by natural selection. And on the Galapagos, you can see a number of creatures that are found nowhere else on Earth, but are very similar in their form, of course, in their behavior, and as we now know, their physiology and their DNA, to creatures that live on the mainland of South America. So, for example, there are these gigantic tortoises that eat leaves and fruits of many land plants. There are smaller tortoises that occur over in South America that look very similar to these. Next. There are sea iguanas that eat seaweed that go surfing out in the ocean. Next. And there are also land iguanas that eat the flowers and fruits of cacti and various other plants. And both of these reptiles are clearly very, very similar to the iguanas of South America. Next. And of course, most famously of all, there are a group of 14 species now recognized of Galapagos or finches, or as they're better known, Darwin's finches, that are found only on the islands of the Galapagos, with the exception of one species that occurs on Cocos Island, a few hundred miles away. Now, Darwin didn't really understand what birds he collected were members of up to so some of them looked like finches, some of them looked like grosbeaks with these big honking bills, some of them looked like American blackbirds, others like wrens, and finally others yet like warblers. So he did not appreciate really until he got back and he gave his specimens to John Gould, a famous ornithologist working in the British Museum, what was going on, and Gould was stunned by what he saw. He dropped everything, and within a few days of being given the specimens by Darwin, recognized that all of them belonged to a single family of birds. And next, led Darwin to completely reassess things, and again, the finches were a great inspiration to him. He mentions in The Voyage of the Beagle, published in 1839 after he'd gotten back, the most curious fact is the perfect gradation in the size of the beaks in the different species. Seeing this gradation and diversity of structure in one small, intimately related group of birds, one might really fancy that from an original paucity of birds in this archipelago, one species had been taken and modified for different ends. Now, the use of the word modified here is a bit weasel-like. It really doesn't give his hand away in terms of thinking, in terms of how they might have been modified. But it's clear, even in 1839, long before, 20 years before the publication of On the Origin of Species, he was thinking about what this might mean in terms of speciation. Now, if you look at the range of bill sizes and shapes. You might come up with this family tree based on the similarities in morphology among different species. And this is a family tree that was drawn by David Lack in the 1940s, based, as I said, solely on morphology. And it turns out a large group of the birds are ground finches. Generally, the males are jet black because they're hopping around on the black lava fields of the Galapagos. And there is a small, medium, and large ground finch, which have small, medium, large beaks up to incredibly large, deep, that is say thick beaks. And they eat seeds of plants on the ground, like finches or grosbeaks do in the New World. There are other species that have somewhat more conical bills that are cactus feeding, that eat the flower buds, the flowers, eat insects at the flowers, and especially the fruits of the Opuntia cactus. There's one bizarre species that we now know often acts as a vampire. It will jump onto the backs of boobies and other seabirds and peck away at the base of the tail until blood is drawn and then lap it up. there are a number of tree finches. There's one that eats mainly flower buds and fruits. It's a vegetarian finch. There are several that feed on insects. Again, you have from small to large beaks. And then there are two, probably there's one species, the woodpecker finch, which is a tool user. It breaks off spines of cacti and then uses that to probe into trees to get at caterpillars. There are no woodpeckers native to the Galapagos, and so this is the finch's response to that. And then there are a couple of species that are quite warbler-like that glean insects off the off the leaves of various trees. Now, when you look at this phylogeny, as it's called, or family tree, there are a number of questions that immediately arise. The first is, you know, where did the finches come from, and when did they arrive? Secondly, is it the case that different beak sizes and shapes are adapted to different diets? And the answer, by the way, is yes, that David Lack, through his own work and the work of many subsequent investigators, especially John Bowman, and then more recently over the last 25 years, Peter and Rosemary Grant, have shown what Darwin did not know, which is the correlation between these beak sizes and shapes and the diets I've just mentioned. Did competition among close relatives favor the divergence that we see among these finches? And then finally, does morphological similarity, which was used to construct this tree, actually represent close relationships? Does it instead reflect similar ecologies and not so close relationships? Or does it reflect both close relationships and similar ecologies? So first of all, where do they come from and when? Next. There are several lines of evidence, and again, and here you see phylogenies, family trees that have been derived from mitochondrial DNA sequences, different sequences on the loop of DNA that lives in each mitochondrion in the cell, that show that the finches from the Galapagos sampled, highlighted in red, form a monophyletic group. That is to say, they're all the descendants of a single common ancestor. And the closest relative in each case is the dull-colored grassquit. Next slide. That's good. And this is a finch-like bird, rather, ordinary-looking bird from South America. It has this range. The Galapagos are right over here. And it appears, based on these molecular results, not only is the dull-colored grassquit the closest relative of the Galapagos finches, But apparently, their ancestor colonized the Galapagos between 2 and 3 million years ago. By the way, the oldest island on the Galapagos currently above water is about 3.5 million years old. There is, however, a string of seamounts stretching off to the east that are up to 80 million years old. So the Galapagos Islands as a chain have been there for a very, very long time. Now, are the different big sizes and shapes adapted to different diets? Well, yes, we know in broad terms that is true, just based on the correlations I mentioned earlier. But through the work of Peter and Rosemary Grant on Daphne Major, we know a great deal more than that in detail. And they've documented natural selection changing in real time the beak sizes and shapes of the Geospiza fortis, the intermediate or the medium ground finch. To demonstrate natural selection, you have only to demonstrate three things. First, that there's variation present in the population. Second, that some of it's heritable. And third, that some of that variation is tied to differences in fitness, that is to say, to differences in the rates of reproduction. So here you see there's variation in beak depth, very clearly, in a population, plotting numbers of individuals against beak depth in millimeters from 6 to 14 millimeters, so from about that big to about that big. The variation is heritable. Here we have offspring's beak depth against the average of the parental beak depth. The correlations vary between years because the food supply varies. And then finally, through work they conducted in the starting in the mid-70s and then has been carried forward actually to today, they found very strong selection, very strong differences in fitness, that is to say, among individuals that varied in beak depth. Starting in 1976, there was a severe drought. Essentially no rain fell in the Galapagos Islands for a few years. And as a consequence of that, the seed abundance went way down, as you see here. The population size of Geospiza fortis, this medium ground finch, went way down. While seeds in general became very rare, only one species really was common, and that was Tribulus. It's a species that has very hard, big seeds that are encased in a tough case, as you see here. And this measure on this graph shows you sort of a measure of how tough the seeds are to crack. It's based on how thick the seeds are and the hardness of those seeds. And so during this drought, the toughness of the seeds went way up. And here you see the punchline. This is what has happened over time from 1975 to 1978 in the average size, the average depth of the bill. So a tremendous difference. Next. So, and in particular, rearranging that same data set to look at percent survival during the drought as a function of bill depth, this is what you get, essentially no survival for individuals with bills 6 to 8 millimeters deep, but then very high survival for those with bills 11 to 12. And you see over quite a range here that a difference of 1 millimeter, right? 1 millimeter can double the chances of survival for very intense selection on beak size and shape. The Grants estimated that you would only need about 20 events like the 1976 and 1977 drought to change the bill size of fortis into that of Magnirostris, that's the large ground finch. By the way, what we're seeing here is then the relaxation down to the original bill size after the drought was over. So counter selection, bringing it back to middle size. Now, do we know whether or not competition among close relatives favored divergence, favored adaptive radiation? Well, in this case, we don't know it for sure. But the pattern of coexistence on individual islands suggests that yes, the presence of close competitors played a very important role. So for example, if you look at the small ground finch, when it occurs alone on the island of Crossman, it has a beak size of about 9 millimeters. which is about the same size as the medium ground finch has when it occurs alone on Daphne. But when they occur together on the islands of Charles and also on the isles of Chatham, you can see that there's been divergence. They're much more different when they occur together than they occur separately, and the same is true when you look at the last species, the large ground finch. So there is indirect evidence, but of course we were not there during the evolution of the finches, and we were not able to document the selection pressures directly. However, in other groups that are now being studied in rather island-like situations, we are able directly to demonstrate selection. So for example, in a few unusual lakes on Vancouver Island out in British Columbia, Dolph Schluter and his colleagues have shown that there appears to have been speciation occurring within individual lakes with a separation between a benthic form that lives among the weeds along the shore and along the bottom from the linnetic form that occurs up in the water column, with the benthic form generally being stockier and slower moving, but bigger and more aggressive, and the linnetic form being more torpedo-shaped. Next. And he's shown that there is adaptive crossover. That is to say that each of these forms is best adapted in the environment in which it occurs. Here you see the growth rate of the benthic and the limnetic forms in the littoral zone, that is to say along the shore, and also plotted against the growth rate in open water. And they did this by basically setting up nets and restricting the animals to different parts of the lakes. And you can see that the benthic form has a very high growth rate on the y-axis in the littoral zone, where it's generally found, and a low growth rate in open water, whereas the linnetic form has a much higher growth rate than the benthic form in open water, so it has an advantage in terms of growth and therefore in terms of reproduction, whereas the benthic form has a big advantage relative to the limnetic form in shallow water. So, you know, there you can see that there is an ecological advantage to this divergence. Next. Schluter has also run some experiments where he's crossbred these species, forming the hybrids, forming a swarm of hybrids that vary in how deep their body is, and found that when you put one of the species into a pond with the hybrid swarm, that the individuals in the hybrid swarm that diverge most from the species present are the ones that survive and reproduce. Furthermore, it turns out that this difference between limnetic and benthic forms has evolved at least four different times independently in the sticklebacks and dozens of times in whitefish in Western Canada. An even more compelling case involves adaptive radiation in a beaker in the bacterium Pseudomonas fluorescens. Here you see across the top row the colony morphology of this microbe. There's the smooth morph, the wrinkled spreader, and the fuzzy spreader, the FS there. And it turns out that these grow in different areas. So the smooth morph occurs generally on the sidewalls. The wrinkly morph forms a foam on the surface, and the fuzzy morph, the fuzzy spreader, down on the bottom. And if you put in broth into a beaker, sterile broth, and then introduce a single cell, then within a few days, you get divergence into these three morphs repeatedly, time after time after time. And the reason for this, of course, is that the bacteria grow, they use up the oxygen, they put waste materials in, and you get stratification of conditions within the flask, and then you have selection for different forms in different parts of the flask. On the other hand, if you simply stir the flask, nothing happens. In other words, just one species remains, one morph, I should say, remains. Now, what about, does morphological similarity reflect close relationship or similar ecology or both? It turns out that lax morphology-based tree is very similar to the trees derived from a variety of molecular sources using similarities in the DNA. So in this case, there's no conflict between morphology and the DNA. Next. But in other cases, there's rampant convergence, and morphology can be very misleading, but also very exciting. So the Rift Lake cichlids have over 800 or 900 species. They constitute most of the cichlid fish of the world that occur in both South America and in Africa. One of the most diverse groups of freshwater fish. They, if you look at fish in Lake Malawi and Lake Tanganyika, you see really striking similarities in the shape of the fish, in their jaw morphology, in their diet. There's a tremendous range of diets in the Rift Lake cichlids in East Africa. If you ask, okay, are these two species more closely related to each other than others, or are these two, or these two, or are the species in each column that are tremendously divergent but occur in the same lake, are they each other's closest relatives? And it turns out, based on the DNA variation, that it's the latter, that basically the species that are tremendously morphologically divergent are each other's closest relatives, that you've had independent adaptive radiations in each lake, presumably because of competition for resources in both of these lakes. These are some rather spectacular fish because of the, at least formerly, clear waters in these lakes. They're illuminated with bright light, and several of these fish, even though they're occurring in fresh water, have colors that approach those of reef fish. The Hawaiian Islands host a lot of striking cases of adaptive radiation, as you might expect. They're the most isolated archipelago on Earth. Next. There's a chain of islands that range from 400,000 to 5 million years old now, but there's a chain of seamounts off to the northwest that run back 80 million years. They're below water. For the most cases, there are some atolls, of course, as well. Next. The Hawaiian honeycreepers, these are just the ones that we got to see. The Polynesians knocked half of them off 1,500 years ago when they arrived on the scene. But they have the greatest amount of variation in bill size and shape of any group of perching birds. They're now greatly endangered because of the introduction of avian pox and malaria, as well as the mosquitoes that transmit it. The molecular data imply a parallel evolution of longbills in the red versus the yellow birds in this clade. And also, it appears that the honeycreepers arrived about 5 million years ago. The morphological data suggests that the pine grosbeak that some of you may have seen at bird feeders up in northern Wisconsin is their closest relative. The honeycreepers have diverged not only in bill size, but also in behavior. So this crested honeycreeper is very aggressive at chasing other birds away from its preferred flowers. Many of these species feed on nectar. Next. There were several giant flightless geese that occurred on the islands about 1,500 years ago. And we know this because of the subfossil, that is a still tissue present. Yeah, give me seven. found in lava tubes. And based on the DNA extracted from those bones, we know that these giant flightless geese were closely related to the Canada goose. There were also giant flightless ducks called the Moanallos that had toothed bills that grazed on the vegetation. These and the geese were the equivalents of antelopes elsewhere. And they apparently were sister to mallards or dappling ducks generally. Next. The fruit flies, a quarter of all the species in the world of fruit flies occur on the Hawaiian Islands. The DNA sequences show they arrived about 10 million years ago on an island near Necker Reef today. Today there are there's no island there, and there are no flies. Next. Family trees based on chromosome patterns and now on DNA sequences show that the diversification has involved dispersal events down the chain from one island to the next younger island in the chain, Presumably, most of the movement is down the chain because as the new islands form volcanically, they're ecologically unoccupied. Next. Adaptive radiation of damselflies, and next. There are even some predatory caterpillars that eat other insects. Next. What about plants? There are about 1,000 species of native flowering plants in Hawaii. Next. About 270 colonizations involved. Next. And long-distance dispersal via stick tights that grab onto feathers or fleshy fruits ingest it are responsible. Next. There are a few lineages that have undergone lots of speciation and account for most of the species. And in particular, next, the top 10 colonizations, 3% of the colonists account for 40% of the current species. Next. The group I work on with my colleagues, Ken Seitzma, and various students, the Hawaiian lobeliads, account for a tenth of the flora, 125 species. They occur in alpine bogs and subalpine openings and cliffs and then in understories and canopies and edges of rainforest. Next. Within the Hawaiian lobeliads, both times in rainforest, where a lot of plants have fleshy fruits. Next. And most of the birds on the Hawaiian Islands, most of the plants in this clade are pollinated by birds, but of course that was true for the lobeliads before they got to the Hawaiian Islands. Next. Our data show that the lobeliads arrived about 13 million years ago, where there's a reef now at Gardner's Pinnacles. That was the largest island, by the way, to ever form in the last 48 million years. So the lobeliads arrived long before Kauai, the oldest current island, supporting lobeliads formed. Next. In Sayonara, there's been repeated parallel radiations in flower length and elevational distribution, and roughly the same number of species on each of the islands except the youngest. And that implies that ecological saturation in this group took about 1.2 million years to complete. Next. Lots of radiation in the Silver Sword Alliance. By the way, this is a morphological taxonomist, a physiologist, and a molecular systematist. Next slide. They're much smarter than the Stooges. And they, of course, involve the silver swords and the Wilkesia's bizarre plants occurring on the rims of canyons in Kauai. Next. And then a whole slew of species in Dubalki, ranging from shrubs in to large trees or even vines. And next, some of the species even have parallel venation, despite their fact their monocotyledons have very strongly reticulate venation. Next. The tarweeds are their closest relatives. Next. And they arrived about 5 million years ago. These last points will go quickly. Rise of arborescence, of tree-like growth form. Darwin realized that this happened he speculated it happened many times. And we now know using DNA information that it has. The reason for it, trees fail to get to islands because they have big seeds. They have big seeds because they have to penetrate the dense litter on the forest floor to get established. But once plants are on islands, there's gonna be competition for light, and that will favor taller plants. Next. And so, that's just the argument, but that's in The Origin of Species by Charles. Next. So we know this has happened repeatedly. So for example, the viper's bug losses from Europe are all herbaceous, but then in the Canary Islands, they've gone woody. And again, we can see that they've evolved from herbaceous ancestors. Next. And this has happened time after time. Scalesia in the Galapagos is trees, but they're related to the sunflowers. Fichia in Tahiti, the beggar's ticks. Next. The tree ironweed from Hawaii. Ironweeds, of course, are herbs in Wisconsin. Next. Violets in Hawaii also are woody. Next. There are tree geraniums in Hawaii. Next. There are various mallows that have gone woody as well. Next. And on Hawaii, in addition to the evolution of the tree-like habit in many groups have also lost their physical or chemical defenses. So you have capriars without the briars, without prickles. Same for blackberries and mintless mints that lack the scent. Next. Gigantism and dwarfism are not part of adaptive radiation. Depends on which niche was unoccupied. Next. So in New Zealand, we had the moas evolve and replace antelopes elsewhere. They were up to 3 meters in height and then extirpated only in the last several hundred years by the Maori. They're closely related to kiwis. The kiwis are the only remaining member of the lineage to survive. Next. Let's skip this. Also gigantism in reptiles, the Komodo dragon. Next, evolved gigantism on islands. Next, much smaller group. Here we have a red who's exceeded grass. But again, tortoises to replace the antelope or deer or bovid relatives elsewhere. And the molecular data show that the Chaco tortoise, a much smaller animal, is the closest relative of the Galapagos tortoise. Next. And they arrived, by the way, 6 to 12 million years ago, long before the oldest island currently above water showed up. In the last 30 years, monster mice that are like two times their original body weight have evolved in the mid-Atlantic on Gouge Island. They hopped off of a boat and they're eating the chicks alive on various seabird colonies. Next, rather gruesome. Finally, evolution of flightlessness in birds and insects. This has happened repeatedly. Why is it? Well, the birds and insects have an advantage in dispersal getting to the islands because they have flight, but once they're there, there are lots of resources that can be used without having wings. They invest enormous amounts of energy in wings and the muscles used to power them. On mainland areas and on islands, they said allocate that to reproduction or other tasks. Next. So, lots of famous cases of flightlessness, the dodo being the most famous. And now we know from DNA that, next again, that the dodo is closely related next to a series of four other members of the pigeon family. It's a pigeon. It's a gigantic pigeon. Next. And these include the solitaire, another flightless bird in the Mascarene Islands on Rodriguez near Mauritius, where the dodo was in the Indian Ocean. Next. And then there's the Nicobar pigeon, which is their closest relative, a flightful bird, large pigeon mainly on the ground in the Nicobar Islands in Southeast Asia. Next. And then these gigantic crown pigeons from Guinea. And next, Samoan tooth-billed pigeon that has a beak remarkably like that of the dodo, but much smaller. Next. Rails have evolved flightlessness many times. Here you see the swamp hen from Australia. Here you see the takahe, a flightless version, over in New Zealand. Next. More rails. Next. The kiwi, of course. Next. One of the most remarkable ones, the only passerine or perching bird that, go back one. You're gone. You're wrong way. Okay. Forward. There we go. Are these St. Stephen Island wrens? Only about this tall. They were mouse equivalents hopping around the understory. This particular species was only known to Western science from St. Stephen's Island between the North and South Island and was extirpated in about a year by one lighthouse keeper's cat. Next. It's all right. It was a very common bird when the Maoris arrived, and the rats they brought with them killed them all over the North and the South Island. The kakapo is a wonderful flightless parrot that I'll end with a short 1 minute clip of in just a second. Again, this occurs on New Zealand and acts sort of like a raccoon. Next. Flightless cormorant in Galapagos. Next. And a lot of flightless insects, not only on islands, but also windy mountaintops. Next. Finally, extinction is a big problem on islands. It's unfortunately the denouement to evolution. And we're responsible in many cases, I'm afraid, because we're bringing in new plants and animals that compete with the existing adaptive radiations. Next. And so in the Hawaiian lobelias, something like 20% of them are endangered or extinct. Next. The ones that had the longest flowers, most specialized to the longest billed birds, are the ones that are most likely to have gone extinct. Next. With the extinction of those long-billed birds, a lot of other bird-pollinated species with large flowers are in great danger in many different families. The snails are going away, the flies, and of course the Polynesians drove extinct half of the birds. Next. One particularly awful scenario involves the introduction of pigs, next, which then wallow in the rainforest understories, creating pools, which then allow the introduced mosquitoes to breed, next, which then bite honey creepers, and next, allow introduced avian malaria to spread, to which they have no resistance, killing them off over the whole range where the vectors, the mosquitoes can live. Next. Now, while we are the problem, we're also in some cases the solution, and really the future of these evolutionary products on islands depend on us. And I just want to end here with a film clip next. And you'll have to actually click on this to get it cooking. Click down here, I think, is best place to click. Or here. Oh, no. Go back. How about if I run this? It's just anyway, the kakapo is now restricted to a single island, just a small island. Oops, that's not the one we want. There's only about 80 individuals left on Earth, and the New Zealanders are exerting heroic efforts to try to save this creature. I just want you to end here with it. Said it's rather like a raccoon, feeds on fruit mainly, as well as some insects, enormously intelligent, made a very loyal pet, sort of like an avian golden retriever, but it was driven to extinction, or near the brink of extinction, by the New Zealanders having introduced weasels and stoats and ermine. It has an unusual breeding system, a lek system where the males have bulls where they emit deep howls, and then the females mate only with the ones that give off the most impressive howls. But then they raise the young themselves, and basically they were killed by the ermines and stoats and weasels on their nest. But the New Zealanders are now protecting them. They're investing millions and millions of dollars to put cameras on every burrow, on every nest, to make sure that rats and other creatures don't kill them. Thank you so much.
Let's thank him. Well, we sacrificed our time for questions. I'm sorry about that, but I don't think any of us would have wanted to miss all those pictures, so. Those of you who are interested, Dr. Givnish will be staying for a discussion with the humanist group, and I think that'll be around 12:30 that we're having the discussion after a potluck. So those of you who would like to stay, you'll get a chance, and of course, he'll be around so you can ask him questions afterwards, too. Now, it's time for our offertory. And we're a little out of order from our order of service. Our offertory music will be provided by our prairie they seem like magicians, but it's musicians.
It depends on the day.
It does depend on the day.
And we also, you are part of this. So
the choir will be joining as well. Yeah, please do stay seated, and pass the baskets to The ushers will be walking in the aisles.
The roads, the words are a little tricky to working with the music. A lot of times at the very beginning of the phrase, you'll have two notes on one word. Go ahead, try it. The chorus, I think that's Ann Locabe. The second line, Ann Locabe. Lots of love.
So this is number 154 in the Rise Up Singing. We have one more little insert into the program. Paula?
Thank you. Probably the most enjoyable duty as being chair of the Hospitality Membership Committee is welcoming new members, and we have three of our newer members here today. I'll ask them to come up front as I say their names, and then I'll ask them to stay here for a few moments while we do a responsive reading. Dave Johnson and Marcia Johnson, longtime friends, and Christina Clock, and Bob and Amy were not able to be here today. I'm sorry, I knew there were more. Jim Carpenter, and did Margaret come? Okay. Can you carry two pots? There's the name right down there. So I'm going to ask you to respond, "We bid you welcome," after each phrase that I say. "We bid you welcome who have found here room for your spirit, who find in this people a family. We bid you welcome. Who come with weary spirit seeking rest. Who come with hope in your heart, with anticipation in your step, who come proud and joyous. Who come with troubles that are too much with you, who come hurt and afraid. Who are seekers. Who come to probe and explore, who come to learn. Whoever you are, whatever you are, wherever you are on your journey, we bid you welcome." Thank you very much. A little, you could set it down, it might be less awkward. So Christina, this is for you.
Thank you.
Okay. Each pot, of course, has one of Mechie's hand-lettered name tags, but they are also getting some granola and a prairie pen and some UU note cards. And you might need a...
One for each hand.
You can? Okay. And... There. Little glitches here. And they are already wearing their wonderful name tags. They have already been given them. Thank you very much. Yeah, take that back in there.
We now have an opportunity for guests and visitors to be introduced, and we hope that you feel comfortable just briefly telling us your name and what brought you here. Also, people who may not have been here for a while or have just been here once or twice, to reintroduce yourselves, that would be great. And Dorothy has the microphone, if you could raise your hands.
Hi, my name is Henry. I'm kind of a recent move to Wisconsin, and I was actually brought here by the lecture, which I found online and looked good. So
good, thanks.
Good to be here.
Anyone else?
Well, my name is Will. I actually usually attend the First Unitarian Society near the campus area, but just decided to look around a little bit, seeing how crowded it is over there, given they're in the middle of remodeling everything. So thought I'd try you guys out.
Welcome. Okay. Please take a look at the announcements in your order of service, which also includes the calendar on the back page. And time for brief pre-announcements that didn't make it into the order of service. It's Marie.
Okay. And then on the 16th of March 2003, Rachel Corrie, a young woman and a political activist, was killed by an Israeli bulldozer when she was protesting the destruction of her home in Rafah, Palestine. In the Orpheum Theater on March 7 and 8, that'll be next weekend, and then at the Overture Center on March 14 and 15, there will be a play created from the writings of Rachel Corrie at 7:30. And I would, if anybody remembers the case of Rachel Corrie, I have a couple of announcements here that you might want to pick up to remind yourselves to go.
Could you set those out on the table outside?
I'll try to get this announcement. We just heard Friday that the next blood drive, UU blood drive, will be at James Reeb Saturday, May 24th. And the last one we oversubscribed a little bit, so I hope we can do it again.
Thanks. And Barb?
The choir get some time off. There's no rehearsal for the next 3 weeks. Two of those weeks I'll be in Florida, and then the third one is Easter. So no rehearsal for 3 weeks. And then you have to come back and work hard.
I have an announcement from our board. I wanted people to be watching those who have access to our Prairie News email, and if you don't, you can approach Dirk and get that access. Dirk is the guy with the vest here. And we'll be sending out the Prairie Fire article, which will also come out in a week or so, but wanted you to know about recommendations we're making for the parish meeting regarding the Fitchburg property. And we're going to be posting that same article in the back of the room here as soon as service is over. And we'll have a couple of written copies for those who don't have email. If you want to take a quick peek at it, that's fine. But please leave the written copies for those who will not be getting it later today in their email. And it's time for our final hymn, number 175. We celebrate the web of life in your hymnal. And please stand. Our closing words today are in your order of service. It is a century now since Darwin gave us the first glimpse of the origin of species. We now know what was unknown to all the preceding caravan of generations, that men and women are only fellow voyagers with other creatures in the odyssey of evolution. This new knowledge should have given us by this time a sense of kinship with our fellow creatures, a wish to live and let live, a sense of wonder over the magnitude and duration of the biotic enterprise. And that's Aldo Leopold that we'll actually be hearing more about later this month in one of our services. I would urge you to greet your neighbor and join us for coffee after the service, and if you're so inclined, for the potluck lunch and for further discussion with Dr. Givnish. And thank you for coming to Prairie today.